Okay. Now, for the last session of this course, I have we have already invited Professor Gary Indeed, who is coming from the Kent in the UK. So, and this is a very good English. That's true. But in fact, he was one of the professors who has one of the famous more well-known about the impact of ice in 2001. So, he's working on standards too, on quality. And in fact, in the last year, he's working on the quality of services. Okay? I know that, that the final of the course has been very stressful here because that's a bit usual, okay? That I used to have some sessions, like there's some invited professors, there's some sessions, and I have to go in the kind of link. But this year, I'm sorry about that because we have two invited professors, so they can come. I'm very pleasure that you can come here, but it's not, I cannot say to Gary, well, we'll come every Wednesday, so it's impossible, we have to come one day after the other, okay? So, just to say thank you for coming, that's it's a pleasure for us to have you here again. I think it's a 4 or 5 year for me. Yeah. 4 or 5 years, it's very fast time going on. And we'll focus the session, and you will see about basically the relation between the quality and the performance. We know that it's very relevant to have quality systems, quality management, whatever, but how we can evaluate if finally we get a better performance. And second one, about quality and service. This is the main issues, how to evaluate quality and service. Then we will talk a little about some kind of theory, and then you will focus in two cases, basically, one about a hotel. Okay? So I think that I always tell that it's the professor that has a better evaluation every year from his course. So that's why I always invite him, because he's the one who gets a better evaluation. And about that story, there is, I don't know if you are able to enter to the survey of the courses. I think it's already open, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so please, at least for this one, please respond. Because there is one part about the professor, another part about the course, about what you think. And this is one part that you can make comments about how the course is going. And maybe sometimes you can say, oh, there's nothing, nobody will read that. But this is not the case, I will read that, and it's very interesting for knowing how the course is going. So please, if you have time, just fill the survey, and just please make your sincere opinions, okay? Whatever you think about how is the course going, okay? I don't know whether you have to go somewhere on the website if it's here for this, okay? So thank you very much, Gary, for coming again. And I told you before that this year we have very good students.
Yes. It's not true,
but it is just true. Yes, it's true. So I hope that you can I will bring the
family. I'll probably manage on my own marketing.
Yeah? Okay. We'll see you later. If I'm going
back. But don't worry about coming.
Okay. We'll see you tomorrow. After the holidays, the time.
Yeah.
And Sarah will make the time. Thank you. Very, very. That's 15 minutes. All the questions with all the books. And you don't have to study anything, you just have to understand the thing that we have talked about in the course. Okay?
Tomorrow
you have class with Yang again. From 5 to 9. Yeah. And Friday 5 to 7. And exam is 7:15. Okay? And then
will this session is being included in the exam?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I write some of the questions.
Yeah, you might have some questions. Okay?
What do we need to study?
What do we need to study? The slides. You have to understand the slides. From the slides. Okay. The slides that I have talking about them, but not all the panel. Not all of them. That's the one that I told. I give you probably 40 slides, but I just use 10 or 5, maybe. You remember? Okay, these 5 slides. Plus the slides from Jerusalem. Okay? But don't worry, all the questions will be on the slides. The only thing is you have to understand. If you have understand, of course, it's going to be. I hope about that. You don't have to understand, it's going to be very good.
So these are some of the questions that we're going to be answering. Marty is copying some handouts, which hopefully we'll bring back if he remembers. So, better quality brings benefits, but what influence does it have on other competitive objectives? How might the pursuit of other competitive objectives, speed, how quickly you do things, think about time to market for instance, dependability, doing things on time, keeping your promises, flexibility. There are four different kinds of flexibility. The way we use flexibility in everyday life is not the way that we think of flexibility here. And, of course, it helps to achieve better quality, but better quality, we will see, also helps to achieve those other objectives. So those are the questions we're going to try to answer today. So, in the past, people used to think that better quality meant more expense.
We use the term quality very interesting, don't we? You know, prepare a car, top of the range Bentley car, and compare it to a BMW Mini. Okay? Both are good quality cars, but they are different from one another. You can't say a Bentley is a better quality car. It is meeting a specification. A specification which is a higher specification. So quality doesn't mean excellence. Quality means, as we know, meeting the criteria that in the end is what customers want, what customers need.
So if quality goes up, it doesn't cost us more. We get market gains, we have a better image. A lot of research was done
about 15 years ago in America, in studies, which showed that the companies that have a good market image in terms of quality were consistently more profitable than those that had a weak image or an average image. So this image brought profitability because it kept price competition down. You don't have to compete on price if you've got a good image, a good brand, which is associated with quality. If you have a better image, it helps to increase your sales volume. Well, of course, that helps to push revenue up. If you have higher sales volume, you also get scale economies because you're making more, you can buy at lower prices, invest in more automation and so on. All of this helps to bring operations costs down. So, that's the market side, but what about operations gains? Well, first of all, if we do things correctly, we don't have to have problems with our after-sales service.
These things,
yeah.
For the sake of the company that made it, and for your sake too, because if that's during warranty, that is a fee
the company to cover. Any profit that they made on this, if it went wrong, down at 10 times over, because to replace this, what they will do is they will give you a new one, they'll put this into another company that will put it right if they can, and that refurbished one will be sold at a lower cost in another market. So, it costs more to put things right later on. Of course, if you do it right, you need less testing, less inspection. Why? Test things every time it is correct. It's unnecessary. If you're testing things 99.99% sure that you're going to get everyone right, well, you don't. Processing times, because if you've got good quality, it goes through the manufacturing system, through the service system without interruption. Inventory costs are down, because if goods are found faulty, a percentage of goods or a whole batch is rejected, that is dead inventory. You have to buy more to replace that dead inventory, you have to spend money on putting it right. So inventory costs down, this brings capital costs down. Think about profitability. You've got sales on one side, you've got costs on the other, and you've got some kind of metric, usually return on assets. The biggest asset in practically every company that is in the Fortune 1000 is inventory costs. This is the highest item in current assets, and where the money is tied up. Bring your workers' fat costs down, because we're doing it right the first time. Employment and warranty costs down. You do it right the first time. Productivity's up, operation costs continue to go down, and profits go up. So quality is good, but you should know this. Okay? Just reminding you that there's multiple paths here. So, these are the five performance objectives. What do they mean?
Yes.
We've got the program.
Apart from the basic articles, having a look here at the two research articles, I don't want to give you sort of 18 pages to read on each article. You'll never get around to reading it anyway. So it's there on the website if you want to read it. But we're going to be summarising that. So we've got these different performance objectives. What do they need? What do they need? Low quality is being right, of course. Speed is being fast. Dependability is being on time, meeting your promises. Flexibility is all about the ability to change. And cost, from an operations perspective, is being productive. So here we have a donut. Does it look like a donut? It looks most unappetizing, this donut. Okay. But what we've got here is the sphere of the customer here. Inside you've got the business. Okay. Each one of these is one of the performance objectives. So, error-free processes, great. Quality. And in the marketplace, it brings error-free products and services. Fast throughput gives us speed. And this gives us quick delivery, fast time to market for these products. Reliable operations give us dependability, which means dependable delivery meeting promises. The ability to change, well, we said this many, many things. So, the maximum choice in the marketplace. This is flexibility in terms of your product range. Over here, finally, this has cost. We want to maximise the value of the customer, minimise the cost, and this, of course, brings benefits, maximising the price and the price value. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to look at how these interrelate. They're quite complex, but we're going to take a little bit of the time, and we're going to show you a film which demonstrates one of these. So, what does quality mean in different operations? First of all, we've got a hospital. Okay? Patients receive the appropriate treatment. We have a diagnosis that goes on in terms of a problem. For instance, I've got a problem in my neck, for example, cranial region of the spine. And this is caused because I'm getting old now. Dear me. One day, maybe it'll happen to you, but it shouldn't have happened to me if I hadn't had a car accident where I had basically a whiplash. This has meant that this degeneration of the cranial nerve in the spine has accelerated. And I went to one doctor, then another doctor, consultants and the rest of it. And it took nearly 2 years to find out what was right. So I had all kinds of treatments that didn't work at all. I was stretched, I was pummeled, I had injections, nothing worked. But now they know what it is. And I'm on a pain management program, which means that I can live a normal life, which is absolutely great. So, the appropriate treatment. Treatment is carried out in the correct manner. Might be appropriate, but it's not done correctly. Unfortunately, it still happens, but every now and then, somebody's has the misfortune to have the wrong leg taken off. And when I've been in hospital, fortunately recently I've been in hospital a lot, now they've got a tag on this with your name and what the procedure is. Tag on here, put a tag around your leg as well. Now, just in case two fall off, they're sure who you are when you're out of it and you're on the operating table, so they don't get it wrong. Will you win? They say, oh dear, we've done the operation on the wrong person. So you end up, yes, perhaps with one lung less or something. Yeah? Fortunate, wouldn't it? So, what you're seeing here, finally, are things that relate to the customer. The patient is consulted and kept informed. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I find that generally doctors and hospitals are not very good at this. They don't tell you how long, they don't wait, they don't keep you up to date with information. So you feel, you know, why am I waiting? Why is this person being seen before me? Now, why do I have to get to the hospital by 8 o'clock in the morning when my procedure isn't until 4:30 in the afternoon? They don't explain things. So because of that, you have dissatisfaction. Now, you can have that dissatisfaction even when staff are courteous, friendly, and so on. Of course, it does help that if you've got friendly and courteous staff,
This does mean it's easier to ask questions and you're likely to get answers to that. Now, that's something. You'll notice some things are exactly the same. When it comes to people, these things stay the same in services. The people element, interaction, which we're going to be looking at in the lecture that we're going to do tomorrow, this is really important. So, buses being tidy, quiet, fuel free, the timetable is accurate, user friendly, and staff are courteous, friendly, and helpful. Now, of course, not in real life. Here, you're detached from the end customer. Who is your customer if you're a car manufacturer?
Wholesalers?
Yeah? It depends, doesn't it? But in the end, it's always the end customer, the buyer at the end, the person who possesses the car that is the important one. Because if you're selling to a dealership, that dealership has to sell it on and so on. So the dealership has to deliver on this, because they are a service company, whereas the manufacturer concentrates on the product. So here, of course, we want product maintenance specification, the product is reliable, the parts are maintenance specification, 25,000 parts in the average car, a lot of things to go wrong, a lot of things to go wrong, and the product is attractive and blemish-free. And it's amazing nowadays. Have any of you been around a car plant? No. Well, you've got one sitting out there below Barcelona somewhere, I can't remember where it is, but we're CF Loop 2. Big car plant there up by Volkswagen. Amazing place to go around. What you do notice is the attention that is made keeping the car blemish free. The car doesn't look like a car, it looks like a paper parcel when it's going down the assembly line. They've got cardboard covers that are moulded to fit on all of the bits that a buckle might scratch against, that a tool might knock, that somebody might knock with their elbow, put a minor dent in or whatever. So the car is completely sort of protected from the environment that it's going through. Because when we get it, we expect it to be blemish-free. It doesn't stay that way for long. You have a car for a year and it doesn't look like that. And finally, a supermarket. Store is clean, tiny, well laid out, the decor is appropriate, attractive, goods. This is what you're in there for, in good condition. And once again, the staff are perfectly friendly and helpful. So you see the service element is important. And more and more, of course, we have service industries, because what we're doing is we're offshoring our manufacturing, so we're becoming more and more service-oriented. So what about looking at that? Well, irrespective of a product or service specification, it has to conform to the specification consistently to prove the benefit of the operation. Externally, enhancing the product or service in the market, or at least it avoids the cost of complaints. Internally, it brings other benefits to the operation. So this is where we start to see interrelationships. Every time there's an error, it slows down throughput speed. Now, what do we mean by throughput speed? I'm going to imagine, guys, you are a production line. You're the first guy in the production line. It's going this way, coming back this way, coming this way, going back this way. It's missing a guy over the end of the camera. And eventually, it comes to you. You finally look at the product, approve it, put it in the box, off it goes.
Okay.
So each one of you spends time on this product and you pass it on to the next person. In between each one of you, there's going to be a little buffer. Okay? Because there will be times when you want to go off to the loo or something, speed my area during the day. So there's little buffers in between you. Now, those buffers added together, plus what you're working on, is the amount of inventory in the system. The amount of inventory in the system dictates the throughput time. Okay? It's the inventory in the system that does that. So, if you have poor quality, you have products which are doing nothing. That slows down throughput speed because you're building up inventory that is needed. You've got a disruption that's going on in the system. So, here's our quality, and these the advantage is speed, reducing costs, and improving competitiveness, as shown on the previous slide. So we're starting to build up all the areas that are going to go into this scale. So speed, what is speed mean? Well, in a hospital, it's very interesting. Time between requiring treatment and receiving it kept to a minimum. One of the procedures that is supposed to be done on my neck, I had the initial diagnosis 2 years, about 6 months ago, but 2 years before that, I had a meeting with a consultant. He said, we'll put you on a list for an operation. And since then, I've gone off and had lots of problems and so on. And about 6 months ago, so 2 years after the event, a letter arrived saying the time for my operation had come. Nearly 2 years, okay? Now, because it had been in the system for so long, things had moved on for me. He'd got it wrong, I found out what was actually wrong with my neck, and it wasn't necessary anymore. If that had been done more quickly, then they would have known whether the operation was going to work or not. Maybe it would have helped a bit, but it certainly wouldn't have done any harm. But that time, all you're doing is you're building up inventory. Now, if everyone who was waiting on a waiting list was in the hospital, it would be congested, wouldn't it? It's only because the inventory has gone home. Okay, it's waiting off-site. But what we've actually got is a huge amount of inventory in the system, which means everything is happening slowly. The test that I had during that, after that consultation, which would confirm the diagnosis, they were done fairly quickly, but all of those tests would have had to be done again. So they were calling me back in to do the test again to be able to do the operation. So, the time for test results. If test results are slow, then it slows the whole process down. And finally, we look how that affects into a bus company. The amount of time you spend on the bus. There's a famous bus in Canterbury, where my university is, that is reckoned to be about the slowest way to get from A to B. This bus, you can walk from A to B faster than the bus takes you. Okay? Because the bus goes off to a village, picks up people, then goes to another village, picks up people, then goes to another, and does a zigzag like this, backwards and forwards through these villages, and eventually it gets to Canterbury. Now, surprisingly, because everybody knows how long it takes, nobody in the early villages ever takes the bus. Crazy, isn't it? Because the speed is so slow it's unacceptable to the customer. But some guy, planning guy, said, oh, this way we can say that we cover all of these villages and that we're offering a full service, but a complete waste of time. You can walk it faster than the bus. And I know that's true because I live in one of those villages. So, in the automobile plant, the time between a dealer requesting a vehicle and the manufacturer. Now, Toyota is fakes, okay? It's just-in-time ideas, this lean system and what have you. And they were producing a car in 18 days, from metal through to a finished car. It took 25 days between an order being taken from a customer and Toyota manufacturing finding out that they needed a car. Crazy, isn't it? 25 days. I don't know why. See, their processes were absolutely terrible. But they never looked. They were looking at manufacturing, manufacturing, manufacturing. And then customers were saying, well, you know, you keep saying how quickly you've come, why does it take this long? And then they suddenly realized their whole distribution function was a complete and utter mess. So they produced it to about 3 days now. It's 3 days still seems a lot of time to process an order. So, cars go wrong. We want to minimize the time it takes to get spares to the individual factors and the factors of the people that deliver that to the cars. To the car repairers. For a supermarket, minimizing the total time of the transaction. Now, there's two kinds of shoppers. I guess this is where maybe there's a sexual development. How many of you guys like shopping? Men?
You like shopping? Hands up. What about you girls? Well, he's a guy. He, girls. You've got put your hands up. Boys who like shopping. Come on. Hands up. Okay. Girls that like shopping. What? There's one. This is weird. When I do this in England, all the girls go like this. And the boys go like this. Maybe it's a cultural thing, I don't know. But my wife doesn't mind spending 2 hours in the supermarket. That would drive me bananas. I have a list, I go around, I pick up things, and I'm out, okay? She goes in with a list, but she comes out with all kinds of things that she never intended to buy, okay? She's an ideal target for supermarket advertising. Oh, 2 for 1, yeah. I have 2 of those. And you weren't going to buy 2 of those anyway. And I moved house recently, and we were clearing out storage, and some things, we had 20 things, because it was cheap, I bought 2 of that, 2 of that, 2 of that, and then you forget about it, okay, so it's just dead inventory. So, sometimes you run out of things, so getting a fast replacement is important. Supermarkets now, like Tesco, which is the example here, they aim to put back on the shelf what sold the previous day. So the information goes from store through to the centre. The centre then arranges the deliveries from the individual manufacturers to the depots. These are depots that don't take in the stock and keep it. They are what are known dock to dock. So in comes a supplier of biscuits, for instance. Whole van full of all different kinds of biscuits from that manufacturer. It goes to a particular distribution depot, which might be for a part of England, for instance. And it comes in, it goes on the shelf, waiting out on the dock are all these Tesco lorries which are going to go to individual stores. And the biscuits, the number of biscuits that are required for that store, this store, and that store, they break up that supply, and there shouldn't be anything left over. There shouldn't be anything left on the shelf. It all goes back into those lorries. Those lorries are being loaded overnight, and they arrive in the morning, and they're putting them on the shelves when you arrive at the supermarket at 10 o'clock. That's what sold yesterday. So this is making great availability of goods, which reduces inventory, of course, which also helps profitability. So what are the internal benefits? First of all, internal problems are reduced. If we have speed, if things go wrong, we can put them right quickly. So imagine our production line here. You guys, it's all this thing here. You make a mistake. I'm not picking on you particularly, but you've made a mistake. It's not picked up until you get here. Okay? Meanwhile, you've been working. This work has been going on all the way through to you. So now we've got to put all of this right, haven't we? Now, if you had 10 between you and you, 10 between you and you, 10 between you and you, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, we have 90 plus 9, 99 items that need to be right. Now, we mentioned earlier, the more inventory we have, the longer the throughput time. So if we reduce the amount of inventory that's in the system, the throughput time is faster. Therefore, you find a mistake more quickly. There's less inventory to put right. So we get a big benefit. Those internal problems are improved. So early correction. Faster speed. Less work in progress, so less holding costs. Inventory. Remember, it's the biggest cost, whether it's in retail or in manufacturing. And there is something called the trumpet of doom. Now, I am not really good at drawing, I've not really drawn this, but imagine this. You know those sort of really long trumpets that they use on special occasions, which have a flag hanging from them? There's the sort of big hole at the end where the noise comes out, it gets narrower and narrower and narrower. And you blow this bit here. Okay? When you were forecasting, further along this time horizon, think of this trumpet, the further you go along, the bigger the error becomes in your forecast. So if you've got a long throughput time, because you've got a lot of inventory that's there, then it takes a long time for things to go through. So you have to plan further and further in advance. Now, if we have the whole production line here, and we have 10 for every person that's here, we would have hundreds. Now, here's the reality. In most manufacturing, it's diabolical. To make a t-shirt takes 20 minutes. 20 minutes, that's all. That's the amount of time it actually spends on something done to it. You think delivery of 7 days is quite good. But actually, it's only 20 minutes to make it. So why does it take 2 weeks to get delivery? There's a company in the UK that makes really high-end suits. You know, so £1,000 up to £10,000. You know, these are the kind of suits that there's the pop stars and other people buy, out of our reach. But they have a six-week time for delivery. And it actually only takes about 9 hours of time to make a suit. So all of the rest is inventory sitting around. Stock, waiting in between the different processes. Okay? So the more stock you have, the further ahead you've got to look, and this leads, of course, to errors. So if we can reduce the planning horizon, we have less planning waste. Planning waste in the sense that we never keep getting right. So we order too much of things we don't need, too little of things where we have to panic and pay more to actually put it right, all of this stuff. Here's our arrows. The speed helps dependability, reduces cost, and improves quality. Now, these things interrelate. So, we can have a vicious circle, and a lot of companies suffer from this. And I do quite a bit of consultancy work with companies. And I often find this vicious circle. What we have, this is a cycle, so where we start doesn't really matter. But if our quality isn't very good, we have more rework. If we have more rework, it takes time to do that, which takes away our capacity. So it's being used unproductively. This in turn leads to higher working process. Higher working process slows throughput. Remember, throughput directly connected to work in process. That means late detection of errors that we've talked about in our example. That means more errors. So we get this vicious circle. And some years ago, there's a consultancy work for a company that produced racks for computers. You know, these you might see them in sort of maybe in your if you're in a big company, could be IT department, big racks which are full of kit. And you know, so they're about 6 foot high, and there's lots of bits of computers and stuff in there. And they used to make racks that the other bits stick into. And they are suffering terribly from this vicious circle here, that very few products went through the first time so that they were actually correct. There's a state it made everywhere. Materials that were being delivered that were scratched, which then meant that later on we had problems and so on. So they were suffering from this vicious circle here. Now, if we can actually reduce our working process, this might help, but if the quality is bad, well, it's not going to really go anywhere. We have to start with getting the quality right, then we can start reducing the amount of work in progress. We can turn something that was a vicious circle into something much more productive. This is a virtuous spiral. Less errors. Less rework. Less work in progress, faster throughput, and faster detection errors. Okay? We turn the whole thing on its head. So you can see these interrelationships are very powerful in quality speed. So I talk for a bit, I'm going to give you a little bit of a break. I'm going to show you a video. It's quite old now, but it's a perfect example of how trying to improve quality is being done by improving. improving the speed that things are being done. Now, the case that we're looking at here in this video is in the printing industry. But we're not looking at the printing part. That's complicated enough. But before anything can go printing, it has to go through what is really a sort of design and development process. So this company is in the business of producing catalogues for birds. Okay, it's an American company, Doubleys. The same would apply, you know, you have catalogues, these big catalogues, it's still a big way of selling. And printing catalogues isn't easy. You've got something that's got 200 pages, it's got lots of pictures in it. The pictures have got to be right because it's the pictures that help to sell the product. Bad pictures, and people say, well, I'm not really sure about that, I don't think I'll go for that. And the more it is to do with the home, matching things in, getting the colour line to be really important. So they call this the prep department. So you've got photographs that have been taken of products, you've got text that's been written by the catalog company, you've got to assemble this into pages for printing, and you've got to make sure it looks nice, but also that there's no errors in it. So we're going to look at this. It's on YouTube, you can look at it. But let's tell you what was the sort of story that is in that particular video. Colour is really, really important in the catalog business. If the colour isn't right, the printing run, then the company who has commissioned 10,000, 100,000 printing run will say, that printing really isn't good. You're going to have to reprint this. Now that is hugely expensive. Now you can't repair it. You've got to just pulp those catalogues that you've been manufactured and remake the whole thing again. Now you can adjust colour in printing, but it's very, very difficult because when you alter it for one picture, you alter it for all the other pictures because all colour printing is laying one colour on top of another. It's called four colour separation. And it's really quite a technical thing to do. You're putting the right amount of three colours, primary colours, and black into a picture to get exactly the right colour. Now, you alter it to make one picture look really good. Unfortunately, it has an effect of altering all of the other pictures that are on that particular run. So on a roller, you will be printing maybe 10 different pages on each roller. And so you alter it for one, you alter all 10. So you might get the other one better, the other ones are not so good. So they were suffering from this problem, and about 10% of their productive capacity has been wasted. Just that customer, and one person is leading that team. That person is the person who talks to the person who's responsible for quality at the catalogue. You've got to get inside that person's head, and it's very difficult to really know what is inside somebody's head, what their decision process is, unless you are the only contact. They found this worked really well. So the guys from the companies were being brought in and saying, we think this is a particular tricky picture that you've got here, you can do it this way, you can do it that way, and would show different alternatives. But there's all kinds of techniques and touching up pictures and so on, which can highlight certain features and so on. So they would get more directly involved in this stage, so that when it actually got through to being on a roller in the printing process, the customer was already happy with the design, rather than trying to put the design right at the printing stage. They increased their productivity massively by some 7%, because there was still some rework that was done, because printing is a messy business anyway. 3%, something like that. But if you pull back 7% of your capacity, this is a gift, a huge gift, isn't it? You can produce 7% more, which means that you can do more work, you can take on bigger runs and so on. So that was the story behind it. And they call it, in this particular video, time-based competition. But really, what it was achieving was quality. They were doing it through time. So I hope you'll have a look at the video and learn something from it. So, bendability. Gone backwards, haven't we? Right. I thought we'd done it then. Okay. Bendability is meeting promises, doing things on time. Life is complicated, just think about your own lives. Yeah. If things don't happen on time, then all that does is put out to your day. Okay? So you're going to work, you're planning your day, you're hoping that this is what you're going to get done. You never get done in your day what you expect to do. Do you? I don't. Do you? Sometimes. Not often. Yeah? I always say, well, that's a good day. Actually, God expected the duty done. Every now and then you have a miracle day where you get more done than you expected. You know, this doesn't happen very often. But often it's other people that have got in the way of you. You know, information that they haven't given you that they said they would. Meetings where people don't turn up and say, hey, no, sorry, somebody else has come up. I'll be rescheduled. So all of these are some broken promises which have a disruption effect. If you're making things, particularly manufacturing things, just one component that fails to come, if you're working on a complex product, will just stop it dead. I used to be in manufacturing before I came into entering, and I learned this very well. I used to make medical instrumentation. They have about 8,000 parts in them, and it's so frustrating. You know, you're ready to go, but there's one part that's missing. One part, and this kit is worth, so each one is £10,000. So you've got hundreds of £10,000 held up for something which costs relatively little, because somebody's in the town and broken the promise that they've made. So if we can get internally and externally on-time deliveries, that means it's great. If we are making promises, that's what we do. We make promises to customers on a good form basis. That is, that we expect things to happen the way we plan them. And what that means, of course, is that when people let us down, we don't meet those promises. So greater accuracy here obviously helps considerably in the planning. And finally, if things are late, you have to spend money and time trying to put it right. Okay? It might be that you've got your workforce waiting for that work, so you have to put something else in its place, which wasn't actually needed at this time. But once you've started on it, it means that that next product is going to be delayed anyway. So you're putting time and effort into inventory, which isn't needed yet, and you're holding up other customers because just one item is late. So, here are our arrows, reliable delivery, helping speed, helping cost. So, all of the arrows, we put all together, we get quite complicated. So, the next one is flexibility. Now, flexibility is a different one, and this is something I want you to get your heads around because we're going to be using it in the case study we're going to be doing later. So, first of all, we have product service flexibility. If we're able to do a wide range of things, we customize things, we are giving people product flexibility. So you go to a McDonald's, there's the choice up there. You can say to them, oh no, I don't want the gherkins, I hate gherkins. They say, well, sorry, you know, that's the way it comes. Now, it's easier for them to do that, okay, to separate out one customer's order, because they're making it to stop all this time, so they're making it to order. So they have very narrow product and service flexibility. On the other hand, high-end restaurant is the absolute opposite. Yeah? You have this massive menu, which of course will give you lots and lots of choice, and if you say, you know, I'm really not that hungry, but can I just have a simple mushroom omelette? And they will say, yes, that's no problem. Or if you're talking about your steak, you say, well, you know, what I really like is an exceptionally rare steak. I just want you to touch it on each side, but it's got to be the very best meat to be able to do that. And they'll do it for you. Standard restaurant, the meat isn't good enough to be able to do that. So, now that will be good product and service flexibility. Then we have mixed flexibility, the ability to be able to do different things. And maybe our range is fixed, but you know, sales differ, don't they? You might have 10 different products, the sales of one goes up, sales of others go down. Having the ability to be able to switch around between those, having that flexibility to be able to do that, is what we call mixed flexibility. Then we have volume flexibility, the trickiest of these. This is the ability to be able to ramp up your production, to do lots and lots more, relatively quickly, and then to ramp back down again. Now, in manufacturing, it's very, very difficult. But in services, they're quite good at it. You know, think about the different days of the week and the pattern of calls to a call centre. You know, a busy call centre, First Direct Bank in the UK, they have just over 1 million customers. They have 15,000 people who work for them. And they've got about 7,000 people that work in their call centres. Okay? And they have rotors so that there's always somebody there, it's 24-hour banking. You can imagine at 2 o'clock in the morning, they don't have a lot of people there. But they have planned it so that they can deal with the peak calls during the day. Okay? They've looked statistically at the past and what the pattern is, and they schedule that volume flexibility to be able to deal with the peaks in demand, and then to take away people as it slopes away, and to deal with the really busy days, which tend to be Fridays and Saturdays. So they have volume flexibility. More difficult in manufacturing because of the amount of kit that's involved. Okay? But it can be done. And finally, we have delivery flexibility, being able to offer flexible delivery. Now, the reality is, of course, companies try to do this, but they do it by cheating. Now, if each one of you have an order on me as a supplier, okay, you place the first order for the same product, the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, 11th, 12th. Now, you're a very influential customer. Very influential because you've been a customer for a long time, very demanding customer, and you say, I'm sorry, but I can't wait for your lead time. You must have it with me in 8 days, when it was 16 days, okay? And what happens? We say yes. What does that mean? It means that every one of you is a day later, okay? Because the 16 people that were in front of you have now had you put in the front of the queue. So I've had managing directors who've said, yeah, Gavin, be more flexible. You know, an operations director. Yeah, we can deliver this big order earlier. I would say, no, you can't. Not without upsetting a lot of customers. No, 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 just be flexible. I would say, okay, we do this. What this will mean is this order's going to be late, that order's going to be late, this order's going to be late. I say, well, we'll just have to manage it. The reality is, you can't. It's a joke. Yeah? We give you your order, everybody else is going to be late. And it's better to tell those people that it's going to be late so that they can plan for it than to actually let them down because your reputation is being shot. Yeah? We had a good reputation until you came along and were demanding something. It's not your fault. Okay. So, we have these different kinds of things. In this case study, I'm going to be asking you to look out for these examples of different kinds of things.
Can you elaborate a bit more about mixed flexibility?
Okay. Say we've got 20 products that we manufacture, okay? Each one of these products is quite different from one another. Now, we could set it up so that we had several units that manufactured these different products. That would not give us much mixed flexibility because if we were really busy in one section, we would say, well, you know, we haven't got enough people here. But if we had a more flexible system, we would be able to say, no problem, because we're not making so many of those. We have a flexible workforce. So we say, people are multi-skilled, so that your particular product that you want at higher volume, I can move people from another department which isn't so busy. So people flexibility in terms of the range of skills they've got would deliver on that mixed flexibility. So the more mixed flexibility you have, the easier it is for you to deal with the fluctuations that are natural in the marketplace, but also exceptional ones.
Could this be used as well in machinery?
In a way, it can, but if you think about automation, there's two types of automation, isn't there? It's flexible kind of automation, and there's fixed automation. Fixed automation is going to be no good for mixed flexibility. But if you had flexible machines that could be programmed to do different things, so that you've got 20 machines, you know, if you go around Japanese factories, they use a lot of flexible automation. You see all these machines, the funny thing is, on the side of them, they've got pictures of pop stars. And you say, what is that? So, well, rather than calling machine R11, they say Madonna. So Madonna's not working well today. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, sort of the way people could actually think. And it's funny, in Japan, they view those machines much more fondly than if perhaps they just called it R11. They think it has a personality. So it's a treat, these are the way people's minds work. But that answers your question. But, you know, you can see how I get diverted from you to me. So, anyway, we have these different kinds of flexibility. And it is important that we start with these different types. So, for a hospital, it would be producing new treatments. This would be product flexibility. So this is the order that we had before. The second, a wide range of treatments, would be mixed flexibility. The ability to adjust the numbers of patients treated is volume flexibility. And the ability to reshape appointments would be delivery flexibility. So, it's the same order in each one of these sites. Product flexibility. Mixed flexibility. Which one's this? Oh, guys. Thank you. Yes. And delivery flexibility. Just checking that you're awake. And here, introduction to new products. Wide range of options, the ability to adjust the number of vehicles manufactured and rescheduled. And for a supermarket, slightly different. So here, new products, a wide range of good stock. It's interesting, over the years, supermarkets have been able to put more and more goods on the shelf. Why? Because they have increased their throughput time. They have reduced their throughput time by the time. By reducing their throughput time, they keep less volume on the shelf. If you, the Tesco example, every day you are putting back on the shelf what you sold yesterday, you only need to have a day and a little bit on the shelf. threshold, and before he had 2 days' worth, that is space that could have been occupied by another product. Now, you have 2 products in space where there was 1 product. And actually, the number of products running in a Tesco store has gone up something like 7-fold for the same size of store. Not by extra shelving, but we've taken out shelving to give more bum room so that we can get around and it's busy and so on. And of course, delivery flexibility, the ability to get out of cell counters. So, for the first time, we have a different colored arrow. Why? Because all of the others are positive, but flexibility costs money. Do you remember your example you were talking about mixed flexibility? Well, if we're going to have multi-skilled people, they are more expensive than people who've got a narrow range of skills. So this increases our costs. If we're going to have volume flexibility, well, inherent in that is the fact that sometimes we will have idle capacity. Think about the average shop in Girona. Most of the time, the sales assistants have got nothing to do. It's idle capacity, right? But if a customer comes into the store, they can serve them. Obviously, over the weekends and in the evenings, some peak times, they are busy. But that flexibility to be able to be open over a wide range comes at any cost. Introducing new products. Well, the reality is all new products have a cost, don't they? You have to develop the product, you've got to launch it into the marketplace. But also from an operations point of view, you've got to learn to do new things. And that means that you are less productive on new products until you've got up to a certain volume. So the more new products you introduce, the higher your cost will be. Finally, delivery flexibility. Well, delivery flexibility can only really be achieved if we have slack capacity. We have to have extra capacity that we can draw on to be able to deliver on that flexibility. Otherwise, all we're doing is we're favoring one person, like the example, over the others. So, a very strong blue line to cost, but advantages from flexibility to dependability. Because if we've made promises and we've got multi-flexible people, then that's going to be helpful. Speed is helped by a certain amount of flexibility, particularly when it comes down to support services or how do we manufacture. In fact, we've got enough time to go into other matters of detail. So, more frequent new products, wider product range, volume and reach. So, we've looked at all the arrows and put all those arrows together, it's really quite complicated. But there are other things that relate to cost. We talked about these relationships, but variety, variation and visibility all push up the cost. So what do we mean by this? The wider the range of products that we have, the less volume we can do on each one. Okay? Unless we become bigger and bigger and bigger as a company. So variety costs more. It costs more for us to eat in a high-end restaurant than it does in a fast food restaurant because the width of range that's on offer is much, much bigger. The wastage is higher, the amount of processes is higher, and so on. By variation, what we mean is to do with whether you can forecast something accurately or not. What is the variation what you expect. So, the word predictability comes to mind. We could deal with volume flexibility in a call center because it's relatively predictable based on past behavior to be able to say what the volumes are going to be at different times of the day. Now, it's because there are so many people involved, there's so many customers that you can actually do this. But when we have variations which are unexpected, then all of these cause disruption and cause higher costs. And finally, visibility. Well, customers are supposed to be king and all that stuff. It's true, but it's also untrue, because the more interaction you have with the customer as part of your process, the higher your cost. When you go on a cheap flight, I'll come in from Stansted Airport on Ryanair. What is the total amount of contact time I actually have with people? It was about, I would say, 65 seconds, something like that. I ordered a cup of coffee. That was it. Printed off my boarding cards. I went to the gate, they didn't even talk to me, just let through. They're just processed. So the amount of interaction, absolutely minimal. Which means that we've got a standardized process, we've got costs really low. On the other hand, when I was in industry, occasionally I used to be able to use the company's private jet, which was quite nice, okay, fly over to America. And that would be very, very different. Chauffeur-driven car would arrive at my home, and the guy would knock on the door and say, "Where is your luggage, sir?" And he would pick up my luggage and put it in the car. I could ask him to sit in the back and say, "Yeah, you know, so I'd like to do this. Take you to the executive jet." And you know, the funny thing is, all this queuing that you and I do, it doesn't happen for these people. You've got a jet that's out there, it goes through this other door. And the screening is a guy sort of looks at you and sort of says, "Am I going to sort of search this guy or not? Am I going to look at his luggage?" And they sort of look at you and sort of say, "Well, you know, it's your plane, it's going to blow up, so the risk isn't ours." And it's cursory, so it takes minutes, and you're out there on the tarmac, on a little bus, out you go, climb up into the plane, wonderful seats, sort of home cinema, all kinds of wonderful things in these executive jets. It's very tempting, I imagine, if you're a chief executive, just to spend your whole life just flying around. That's great. But anyway, this is customization. Severe customer, it's very, very expensive. And every year, in board meetings, there will be big arguments about the cost of the company jet. Okay? Because shareholders will say, "Why do you need a company jet?" But the chairman liked a company jet, and he would stick up for it every year, but it's nice. But that is very high visibility, lots and lots of interaction, very, very expensive. So it's the amount of interaction. And then we've got the internal performance objectives, quality, speed, and all of these bring us advantages in terms of cost. Flexibility comes at a price. So very tempting for companies to say, "We want to be lowest price, the best quality, to have the best delivery, time delivery, and to be flexible." Yuck. You do all of those. Keep flexibility out of it. Okay? Unless flexibility is the key to winning customers, then it shouldn't be something that is driving what you're trying to do. Unless cost isn't important. In most markets, cost is important. And quality is important, speed's important, meeting promises that be dependable is important. If people are asking for flexibility as well, that means that you are very unlikely to be cost effective. So, one day maybe you'll be in a position where you're deciding what the most important things are for your company. That's a good way of thinking about this, and that is, think about the Olympics. In order to get to the Olympics, you've got to qualify. You've got to qualify at a national level. The same thing happens when a customer is deciding whether to buy things from you. There is a shortlisting process that goes on. And it could be that you're saying, "Well, I don't want to wait too long. The product has got to be delivered within the next 2 weeks." So you're really saying a qualifier is that the speed is 2 weeks. There could be lots of people that do 2 weeks. It's not something that is going to win you the order, but it's something that's going to qualify you to be considered for the order. You might want a product that has got a good reputation for quality, but it may be there's lots of people that have got a good reputation for quality. That is
qualifier. If you don't have a good reputation for quality, you will not be considered. The same might be true of dependability. Lots of companies are saying, yes, we've got good on-time delivery performance. And then you're saying to yourself, well, really, for me, if those qualifying criteria are met, I have an order-winning criteria. My order-winning criteria is going to be value to me, which is usually dictated by price. Okay? You don't want to spend more money than you need to. And these, of course, are qualifying levels. If you're a company doing better than your competitors on these three, if they are qualifying, is not going to win you the order. But being a company which has lower prices because of reduced costs is going to win you the order. That means that bringing any idea of flexibility in is going to kill you dead. Trying to do that is going to kill you dead. On the other hand, if flexibility is what the customer is really after, then these become qualifiers. Price doesn't become important anymore, it's not the key. It's achieving this flexibility here. Now, the reality is, if you think about all the developments that have been in retail during your lifetime, during my lifetime, it's been to specialization. Nowadays we have quick fit garages, which just concentrate on tyres, exhausts, simple things. Okay? Before, we used to have all of these things done in a full service garage, which would service your car, repair your car if it was in an accident, do all of those things, by concentrating on a narrow range of things, reducing their variety here, increasing their volume. They've been able to be lower cost providers. So everything pushes in the direction of variety being reduced. Flexibility was sacrificed to do that. Wide range of things that the garage could do in the past, that's gone because it's being served by a focus on a narrow range. And that's been the direction. There's some reverse things that are going on. Yeah, we have boutique hotels, smaller hotels, which are aiming for customers that are less price sensitive. We have beauty banks in the US. There's a very famous bank in the US that has a waiting list of customers. It services only people that can have a current account which has got more than £1 million in it, dollars. They guarantee on their card, they give the customer, that any check of any value will be met by a bank, like a bank draft. Okay. They do this and because of the prestige that this brings, because you've got people queuing up to join this club of the super rich that are able to actually be able to afford paying, I think they pay £10,000 a year as a fee for being part of the club, and a joining fee of something like £100,000. Where people come out of their house and explore their finances and what have you, and they take over the running of the finances of that person, their portfolio of investments. They employ the lawyers that look after it, so they've got a whole service. So you can imagine pop stars and the kinds of people that are very good with money and organisation very much attracted to this bank. So it's making a fortune out of the fact that it's charging a fortune because it's so highly desirable. But, of course, it has relatively few customers. So this is the kind of bank that you can send them a text and say, can you bring me £10,000 in a suitcase? And a guy will turn up with £10,000 in a suitcase. Okay? So there's also a lot of unsavory characters who want to join this bank as well, which is why they have this big upfront fee and vetting process, because they don't want drug money or what have you going to the bank, so it will kill the reputation of the bank. So, cost, very much affected by these. Flexibility is a disadvantage. So here's all our arrows all together. Okay. You can see one blue arrow there, emphasizing flexibility does come at a cost. But these speed and dependability and cost are all helped by quality. Speed helps quality. Dependability is helped by quality and speed. So these are virtuous things to have together. One of them might be the order winner in your particular business. The others might be qualifiers. But you can use your qualifiers to help achieve maybe speed, being quicker than other people. Better quality, more dependability will help that speed. So understanding these relationships in your own business, and you know, I've done this in a more generic way, if you try to pop your head around that when you've got the exams over, it might help you to actually really understand what's going on in your business. I think it might give you insights. So, we're going to finish the lecture by looking at this four-stage model. This was invented by Hayes and Wheelwright, some research they did in America. These are guys from Harvard Business School. And they looked at a lot of companies in the US, and they characterized them as being at different stages of development in terms of how well their operations contributed to the business. Stage one, where they start holding the organization back. Stage two, where the aim was to be as good as competitors, but as followers rather than as leaders. Being the best in the industry, or trying to be the best in the industry. And finally, these exceptional companies which redefine the industry's expectations. This term, world-class companies, is thrown about a little bit too freely for my liking. But there are some world-class companies in every industry, and those world-class companies, they do redefine what is being done within that particular industry. So, you might think to yourself, how can any organization survive at stage one? And surely the marketplace will just say, no, we will go somewhere else. Well, here's the rub. A lot of the public service is in stage one. They're there because we have no choice but to use them. Obviously, they're looking for savings in the public sector, but there's a huge sort of lack of imagination in the public sector. I hope it's not quite as bad in Spain as it is in the UK. Now, we were talking about speed and the advantage that speed can bring. One of my students, their dissertation was looking at where they worked, their mature students, like yourselves, working in different industries. This person was working in the public sector in a benefits office. So it was a very specialist benefit. It was called a death benefit. This death benefit, its history goes back a long, long way. It's not a lot of money, it's £1,000. You can apply for this if you've been in the country for a certain amount of time, you've made a certain amount of contribution into your insurance plan, which is the government's insurance plan, and so on. So you get this one-off payment of £1,000. It's all done in one place in the UK, which is in Canterbury. And when it was mapped to show all of the processes that were going on, it looked absolutely horrendous. You couldn't get, and I had these maps, we were printing them, sticking them all together, covering this wall here, it's just so complicated. So, bit by bit, we came up with different ideas about how we could redesign the process. And their bosses said, yeah, you know, we'll let you have five people, okay, from the organization that employs about 300. They have five people. You can make it work with these five people in this new process. We'll adopt it. Well, to cut a long story short, the throughput time, something like 8 weeks, was reduced to 3 days, with a third of the people, and the people that were working it loved it. They didn't feel pressured in any way. Did they adopt it? No. You know why? Because it would mean a massive loss of prestige for all of the managers that were involved. Because
the amount of money they got paid was based on the number of people that they were responsible for, their position in the organization, their budget. So the organization would have been reduced tremendously. People would have lost their jobs. And they said, well, that's a big one. Somebody can come and impose this from outside, but we're not going to volunteer for it. So horrendous, really, isn't it? Yeah? Yes, those people would have been at work, but they could have been redeployed elsewhere within the public sector, probably. I don't know. But there's such huge wastage. So they are there. The corner shop sometimes sits there. It's convenient. We go there to buy our milk, our bread or whatever. It's not terribly good, the prices aren't terribly good, but it's there. It's just convenience that helps us there. So to get to stage two, we've got to have a different thing. We're sort of thinking, well, we've got to keep up with what is going on in our industry. So here we have copying behaviour. So at stage two, what we do is we look at what our competitors are doing and we follow their example. So they've introduced IT to do something. Oh, well, you know, everybody else is doing it, we better do it. So they're never going to be incredibly competitive compared to other companies, because they're always behind, they're copying. Oops, ahead of ourselves there. Next stage here, stage three, is where you have an operation strategy. Now, we've talked about those four performance objectives. An operation strategy says, this is what we are expected to do on these performance objectives. This is the one that we are going to be better than everybody else on. That is our aim. It might be speed. If that is what's really important to customers, it might be quality, whatever is the order with it, the thing that really is important to your customers, that's the one that you focus on. The others, you say, right, okay, we can be better on those than our competitors, but only if it helps us on our primary goal. So we have an operation strategy. It's thought through, we know what the business aims are, we've thought about those performance objectives, and how we're going to deliver on those. We have a strategy. Finally, we get to the next level. Now, we can have an operation strategy, we can have a little business here, but really how do you manage people and harness the power of people is the difference between stage three and stage four. Stage three companies can still be quite hierarchical, where there's relatively little participation and so on. And there are lots of stage three companies in China currently that are doing really well as manufacturing companies, but they will never be stage four companies because they are hierarchical. They don't harness the energies of the people that work for them. All of these companies that are at the top here, they view their employees as a remarkable resource. Every person in these organizations is viewed as not being somebody who does a particular task, brings their hands or their brain to a limited task. Every one of them has got a brain which is good at knowing what is being going on around them and understanding that and being able to contribute to how it could be done better. So, in these companies, they are proactive from a strategic point of view. They're looking at the direction that the industry in the future, what ideas they are. These are the people that invent these management fads that other people follow. Like Six Sigma, Motorola invented the Six Sigma methodology, then taken up by GE and made a huge difference to GE. But Toyota, Toyota was one of those companies. I'm not sure that it's really kept to its best form. It was found the problems with Toyota cars. But they invented that lean methodology. They redefined the industry's expectations. That is what we mean by So, we finished the lecture. Now, what we have next is the case study.